Now remember, we talked about the fact in the last Bible study that Israel had left Ramesses and they were traveling to Succoth, and that the days of unleavened bread were in progress. Then we pick up the story here again in chapter 13. And we're going to see in verses 1 through 2 that these verses are linked to the previous Passover instructions. And again, the days of unleavened bread are already in progress. Chapter 13, verse number 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine." Now notice the word consecrate. It's not unusual for God to consecrate anything. Consecrate means to set apart, and especially for spiritual purposes. God set apart, consecrated the Sabbath. Later on, he would set apart the tabernacle. He would also consecrate, set apart the Levites. So here we see the instructions are to consecrate or set apart all the firstborn of the children of Israel. Now regarding the firstborn, going back to Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, if you recall, God told Moses, "Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn.'" God told Moses to tell this to Pharaoh when he told Moses this in the land of Midian. "Tell Pharaoh, Israel is my son, my firstborn." So God's instructions here that they were to consecrate, set apart the male firstborn of man and animals. And the details of this are going to be explained in verses 11 through 15. And we'll eventually get there. Expositors adds this, God had already set apart the firstborn of Israel. They were spared from the death. God had already set apart the firstborn of Israel on the day he smote all the firstborn of Israel, of Egypt. So again, they were set apart in the fact that they were spared from death. Again, another quote from expositors that's interesting. The sanctification of all the firstborn was commanded by God, probably at Succoth, the first stopping place. And it fell within the 7 days set aside for the days of unleavened bread. So they march from Ramesses to Succoth, they make their camp, and then they're given these instructions about setting apart the firstborn. So to tie that in then, more details of unleavened bread are given in this chapter, verses 3 through 10. The days of unleavened bread had begun, so now they're given more reminders about it. Verse number 3. And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." Then God adds, "No leavened bread shall be eaten." Verse number 4. On this day you are going out in the month Abib. So remember, in the previous Bible study, it had been announced that this month shall be, God presented his calendar to the children of Israel, going back to chapter 12. Now, in verse number 4 of chapter 13, it's named the month Abib. It had been revealed in chapter 12, and now Israel is told its name. Unleavened bread is to be eaten for 7 days to serve as a reminder of coming out of the bondage of Egypt. Verse number 5. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. So God said, when you come into the promised land, you shall keep this service, referring to the days of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Verse 7, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. So again, no leaven shall be seen among you, because leaven represents everything that's contrary to God. and especially represents sin. Verse number 8. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. So again, here again in these instructions, they're told to tell your son so that later generations would understand the significance. Teach your children. Verse number 9. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand, the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. Notice that this was to be a sign on their hand and as a memorial between your eyes. Expositors points out very importantly that this injunction was figurative and a proverbial mode of speech. So that this was to be a sign on their hand and a memorial between their eyes was figurative, not something to be taken literally. And the reason why that I'm pointing this particular point out to you that it was figurative is that the Jews, when they returned from the Babylonian captivity, they began to use this section of scripture, Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 through 16, and they would write these scriptures out on little pieces of parchment and put them in little boxes, which are called phylacteries, and they'd put it on their forehead and on their chest. You've probably heard of these boxes called phylacteries. It also contained other sections of scripture. But it would contain verses 1 through 16 on it that they would wear on their forehead or on their arm. I like what the Nelson Study Bible adds. It says, God's instructions, his instructions here, were to become a rule for one's life. In other words, to be in your heart, in your mind, not in little boxes on your head or on your arm. Not something that is literally being taken, but it's figurative that God's instructions were to be a part of our lives. Verse number 10. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. So the importance of the days of unleavened bread was to be remembered annually by keeping those days of unleavened bread. Now the chapter shifts again, and it talks about the instructions to the firstborn. The first two verses said to consecrate the firstborn, set them aside for a specific purpose, spiritual reasons. Now verses 11 through 16 explains the instructions. Verse number 11. And it shall be, here's the time frame, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the promised land, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, verse 12, that you shall set apart for spiritual purposes to the Lord all that opens the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have. The males shall be the Lord's. God has told the children of Israel to set apart the firstborn, consecrate them for specific spiritual reasons. When they come into the land of the promised land, eventually they're going to be building the sanctuary. God had the firstborn set apart to do the work of the sanctuary, to do priestly duties, etc. So that's why they are being set apart, to do the work of the service of the priests in the sanctuary. Later on, it's going to be changed from the firstborn to the Levites doing the work in the sanctuary. But this is the way God set it up at first, that the firstborn would do these spiritual duties. So this phrase, set apart or consecrate, the Nelson Study Bible, the idea is to treat as distinct, to mark out as special. The term males qualifies the term every firstborn. So to do these special duties that God would have them perform. Verse 13, which included sacrificing as well. Verse 13, but every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man, your sons, you shall redeem. The Nelson Study Bible. A firstborn donkey was redeemed with a lamb. A donkey was not allowed as a sacrifice. That the pagans liked to sacrifice the donkeys, but it was not allowed with the children of Israel. Continuing on, similarly, the Israelites were to redeem their firstborn sons. They were never to slay them in human sacrifice. So again, they're set apart for a special service, and there's a sacrifice involved as well. The last part of verse 13, the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And Haley's adds this, as a reminder of their redemption by the death of Egypt's firstborn. So that's why the firstborn were to be redeemed back, to remind the children of Israel that they'd been saved by God from the death plague. Verse number 14, continuing on with these instructions about the firstborn. So it shall be, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? That you shall say to him, by strength of the hand of the Lord, by strength of hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That's what this redeeming has to do with. Verse 15, and it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. So this was a reminder that they had been spared from death, even though the firstborn of Egypt had not. So when they come into the land, firstborn male clean animals are to be sacrificed to the Lord. Part of the duties the firstborn were to perform. We see the mention of the firstborn males of men and unclean animals were to be redeemed, bought back from God. An unclean animal would be redeemed by the sacrifice of a lamb. And man, regarding man, an offering would take the place of a literal sacrifice. No human sacrifice like the pagans did, but they would use an animal in sacrifice. And again, this is all these instructions is to remind the children of Israel that God had redeemed them from death and brought them out of slavery. What I just said in this particular frame, this offering would serve as a reminder of how God miraculously delivered Israel from Egypt. And in verse 16, it shall be as sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. So this is what they would be doing when they came into the promised land. Verse 17, now we get back to the story of the children of Israel as they march, and again during the days of unleavened bread. Verse 17, then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the Philistines, although that land was near. And God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. And I'm going to show you a map real shortly describing this. The shortest route to Canaan was through the land of the Philistines. Bible Knowledge Commentary. This shortest route led along the Mediterranean Sea, the military road of the Egyptians. That's why God did not want them going that way. But the route chosen by God was southeastward toward Sinai to avoid possible military confrontations with Egyptian guards who might encourage the people to return to Egypt. Egypt, again, the most powerful nation in the Middle East at that time. They had their forts and their garrisons all around Egypt to protect their nation, and especially on the road to the Philistines. And God did not want them encountering those particular garrisons and forts. Haley's adds this, the direct route by the seacoast was garrisoned with Egyptian armies. And here's something interesting. At that time, there was a great wall from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. The most feasible route was the roundabout way through the wilderness. So Hales was saying that there was a wall that they had built. And again, this was to keep their enemies out. And they had forts and garrisons. Verse 18. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. I think there's some important things to stop and contemplate here for a moment. First of all, notice the term the Red Sea here in verse 18. This is the only place in these chapters, in chapters 13 and 14, where it's actually named the Red Sea. In the other verses, we'll see as we go along, it's just called the sea. Here it's called the Red Sea. And notice that they came out in orderly ranks. 2 million people with mixed multitudes amongst them, all their cattle, their livestock, and they're in orderly ranks. That took some time to set that up and do that for the children of Israel. This term, the Red Sea, comes from the Hebrew Yam Suf, which literally means sea of reeds or weeds. The Nelson Study Bible says, the rendering the Red Sea comes from the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, completed around 150 BC. The Hebrew phrase means the sea of reeds. Now, Bible critics, skeptics, will often take this and use it and say, aha, that's why the children of Israel were able to go through this so easily. They just literally parted these reeds, these weeds, and went through it. But that doesn't explain how these walls of water actually drowned the Egyptians and all their chariots and horses, etc. Because it was a miracle, despite their skepticism, that God had performed a miracle and the Egyptians were drowned. But the literal term is sea of reeds or weeds, possibly because there was seaweed on this particular, it was known for its seaweed in that time. Okay, here's this map that I told you we were going to look at, map of Egypt and Sinai. The way of the Philistine, way to the land of the Philistines, the shortest route, as that arrow is pointing, was right up here along this Mediterranean Sea coast. Here is where the children of Israel, here's Goshen down here, lower Egypt. The shortest route was along there. However, the Egyptians had their forts and their garrisons along there to protect them from the Canaanites up here. So God didn't lead them that way. The route of the Exodus, come on clicker, was actually through the Sinai. Down in this area was Mount Sinai where the law was given. And they actually came up through here, went around about, and that way into the land of Israel. That was the actual route of the Exodus. Also, I'll point out something to you, is here's where they left from Ramesses, and they went to Succoth, that day's journey. Apparently, they started out going northward on the journey. But as we come to chapter 14, we're going to see God makes them turn and go south. They're going to turn and go south. And we'll get to that when we come to chapter 14. Okay, now we come to a scripture in verse number 19 of Joseph's prophecy being fulfilled. Verse number 19. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he placed the children of Israel under the solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. Here's that prophecy. Remember back in Genesis chapter 50, verse 25, Joseph said, he took an oath from the children of Israel saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Joseph prophesied when they would be leaving via the Exodus that they would carry his bones back to the promised land. And we see it's being fulfilled here in verse number 19. They're taking his bones out. Verse number 20. So they took their journey from Succoth, where they had made their first encampment, and they camped in Ethan at the edge of the wilderness. Days of unleavened bread are still underway. And they come to another place called Etham at the very edge of the wilderness, dividing Egypt from the desert. Keelan Delitch adds this. Etham was at the end of the desert. So that it was where Egypt ends and the desert of Arabia begins. From Etham at the edge of the desert, which separates Egypt from Asia, the Israelites were to enter the pathless desert and leave the inhabited country. They're leaving the land of Egypt, the breadbasket of the Middle East, all the cities that they had built, all the splendor of Egypt, and they're going to be wandering in the desert. Verse number 21. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. Verse 22. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by the day, or pillar of fire by night from before the people. So here we see that the Israelites witness another miracle from God. Miracle upon miracle upon miracle from God. A pillar of cloud during the day, which gave them shade from the heat of the afternoon in the desert, and a pillar of fire by night providing a warm glowing light. I like what Haley's adds here. It says, as they left Egypt, now to journey through hostile lands, God took them under his own care with this visible sign of his guidance and protection. We're going to see as we come to chapter 14, they're going to be passing by Egyptian forts. They're going to be going into hostile lands, and they've got women, they've got children, they've got all their livestock. But God was with them with this pillar of fire, or the pillar of cloud to lead the way, and pillar of fire at night. Again, a miracle. Here's a companion scripture, Psalm 105, verse 39. He spread a cloud for a covering and a fire to give light in the night. New Bible commentary adds this. God remained in close proximity of the Israelites, indicating his special relationship with them. God was not going to forsake or leave the children of Israel. Now we come to chapter 14. Again, the days of unleavened bread are in progress. Verse number 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea. Remember I mentioned on the map that they apparently had started northward towards the Mediterranean Sea, but God had them turn now to go south. Verse number 2, they changed direction, probably to a southern route. Notice, Migdal, which is one of the places they were to camp by, means tower or watchtower, and it was an Egyptian fort with a garrison of soldiers. And Pi-Hahiroth was another Egyptian garrison. So the children of Israel, they turn, and now they're going to camp between these Egyptian forts. And the Egyptian in the garrisons are watching this. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to send their messengers back to Pharaoh. Hey, what are these Israelites doing? They're heading north to take the short route. Now they come back and they're camping in between us in the forts. Verse number 3. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. So they're to turn. This led Pharaoh to believe that they were confused. They were now trapped, he figured, between two Egyptian forts, garrisons, and the sea is ahead of them. I've got them where I want them. Verse number 4. God says, then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So even though we've seen previously that Pharaoh had finally been humbled by the 10th plague, he lets Israel go. Now he gets this idea, aha, they're trapped. Maybe I can get them back. We're not going to lose this good thing of all this slave labor. Verse number 5. Now it was told the king of Egypt, probably by one of the messengers from the fort. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants were turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we've let Israel go from serving us? We're losing out on this good deal. So he made ready, verse 6, his chariot and took his people with him. So Pharaoh was encouraged because he thought Israel now is trapped, indecisive moves, and he knows his military strength. Verse number 7. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. This is some of the finest military that Egypt had. Verse 7 says, 600 choice chariots. These were made up of the king's specially trained young warriors, some of the best warriors of Egypt. And they were known for their fast gallop across the desert. And also, all the chariots of Egypt would be involved from the many garrisons. They would call out chariots from other garrisons to come as well to bring back Israel. Here's an interesting quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The principal military force of ancient Egypt consisted in war chariots. It appears everywhere from the monuments that the pharaohs headed their armies in person. That's very, very interesting, that quote, that pharaohs headed their armies in person. Not like the generals who would stand on the hill and watch their fighting forces down in the valley fight. The pharaoh actually led the charge with his chariot in the front. This is very important, though, because the question often comes up, well, did Pharaoh actually die in the Red Sea? Well, the text does not say, as we'll see as we go along, that Pharaoh actually dies. But being the fact that he led his chariots as he normally would tells us that, yes, most likely he did. Verse number 8. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, made him stubborn, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. Verse number 9. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. Notice in verse number 9, all the horses. Barnes notes says that the horses were thoroughbred horses, renowned for their strength and spirit. The chariots of Pharaoh was the common two-person car. Barnes says that each of these were drawn by two horses with two men, one bearing the shield and the other and driving, and the other fully armed. Also, we see in verse number 9 that all of his horsemen and his army were engaged. Josephus, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, says that along with the 600 chariots, Pharaoh had 50,000 horsemen and 200,000 footmen. Now, if Josephus was correct, that was a huge, huge army. Some of the best warriors in a huge army. Verse number 10, and when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. When you understand all the force that was coming at them, and the children of Israel looked and saw all that force, you could see why they got scared, and they cry out to God. Verse number 11. Then they said to Moses, now here's where they lose faith, even though God had shown miracle after miracle to them. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Very sarcastic on the part of the children of Israel. You know, we would have been better off in Egypt, is in other words what they were saying. Verse number 12. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Children of Israel just didn't learn the lessons. God was with them. Notice they said, no graves in Egypt. Expositors says, they mocked in the most satirical tone possible. Since Egypt specialized in graves and had about 3/4 of its land available for grave sites. So the Egyptians, they were known for their grave sites, you know, their mummification, they mummied their dead and such. And so the children of Israel are very sarcastic in what they say. Bible Knowledge Commentary adds, Quickly forgetting the past, they bitterly accused Moses of deceiving them by leading them into the desert to die. Lessons for all of us. God is there. He's with us. Verse 13. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still. See the salvation of the Lord that he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see, 200,000 footmen, 50,000 horses, 600 chariots of Pharaoh, you're not going to see them anymore. The Lord will fight for you," verse 14, "and you shall hold your peace." Excellent words spoken by Moses. Verse 15, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward.'" Verse 16, "But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." Sometimes people ask about this phrase, why do you cry to me? That's actually a figure of speech. The Companion Bible says that it's a figure of speech. It's a question asked in a positive affirmation. So it's something positive in its nature. In other words, it'd be like saying, "Moses, don't just stand there. Tell the children of Israel to go forward." Verse 17, "And indeed, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and all of his army, and his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." God says, "I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians." This is the first time that this is used. Pharaoh's heart had been hard. We'd seen that many times. But now we see all the hearts of the Egyptians, all their soldiers, are going to become stubborn, and they'll follow. Despite the fact that these Egyptians had seen miracle upon miracle by God, they see these waters departed, and they pursue after the Israelites. Verse number 19, "And the angel of God, who went out before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it became the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was, a cloud and a darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night." The Nelson Study Bible adds, "The name the angel of God is an alternative expression for the angel of the Lord. The pillar is later associated with the Lord himself," Exodus chapter 33. Verse 21, "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into a dry land, and the waters were divided." Verse 22, "So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea and on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on to the left." And I imagine that was quite the sight to see, with that walls of water, and they're going through that dry ground. So again, this was not, as critics would say, a sea of reeds that were parted. This was a literal miracle that had taken place. Expositors adds this, "The separation of the waters must have been somewhere around 1/2 mile wide to allow 2 million people to pass over in one night." That's how wide it had to be, at least 1/2 mile wide for 2 million people to go by in one night. Verse 23, "And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen." Verse 24, "Now it came to pass, in the morning watch," which was between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m., "that the Lord looked down." And when God looks down, it's usually in judgment, like he did Sodom and Gomorrah and the Tower of Babel. "That the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians." The Nelson Study Bible adds, he caused confusion to fall among all the Egyptians in the morning watch, while it was still dark. Here's a companion scripture that describes how God troubled them. Psalm chapter 77, verses 16 through 19. The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. Notice verse 18. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. In other words, there was lightning. There was probably an earthquake, as it says, the earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea. Your path was in great waters, and your footsteps were not known. So this explains how the Egyptians were troubled. Verse 25. And he took off the chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. They had immediate flat tires, in other words. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel. They finally came to the end where they had to admit, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. The Nelson Study Bible. This was the confession the Lord demanded, and word spread widely. The Lord fought for the Israelites. Verse 26. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back on the Egyptians, on their chariots, and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Companion verse, Hebrews 11, verse 29. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. So a New Testament testimony of what happened anciently. Verse 28. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them, however many thousands there were, like Josephus had said. Not so much as one of them remained. Companion Bible says, this implies that Pharaoh himself did not escape. That question comes up quite often. Did Pharaoh escape? Expositors adds, the text never says that Pharaoh himself died here, even though Psalm 136:15 records that God swept Pharaoh and his army into the Red Sea. And I have that for you here, Psalm 136:15. But overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea, for his mercy endures forever. But, verse 29, the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Now, the Jewish tradition is that this took place on the last day of unleavened bread. That's nowhere confirmed in the scriptures, just Jewish tradition, but it could very well have been. Barnes Notes adds this, the waters served the purpose of an entrenchment and wall. The people could not be attacked on either flank during the transit. Notice the waters formed a wall here as the children of Israel went in the midst of them. Water is a symbol of baptism. Israel left Egypt and went on to left Egypt, symbolizing sin, and went on to a new life. Just like those who are baptized, immersed under the water, come up again clean to live a new life to God. Symbolism here within these verses. Verse number 30. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Barnes notes, when they passed the Red Sea, their independence of Egypt's power was sealed. Their life as a nation then began. Verse 31. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant, Moses, for a little while, believed them. A couple more quotes as we finish up the Bible study here today. The great work, Nelson Study Bible. The great work literally means the great hand. That is, God did it. And we see that the people feared the Lord and believed his servant Moses, Bible Knowledge Commentary. The people often fluctuated between trust and complaining between belief and unbelief. And that's something that is a lesson for us not to do. Always have faith in God. And I'll leave you with some lessons here as we finish up the Bible study. You can smell the pizza that's been delivered over there. Lesson number one. Israel witnessed tremendous miracles, but they did not show the faith and trust in God. They complained and murmured against their deliverer. Why have you brought us out of Egypt so that we die in the desert? And as we go through the next Bible study, we see they murmur again. Oh, sorry, I didn't have that up there for you. Israel witnessed tremendous miracles, but they did not show the faith and trust in God. They complained and murmured against their deliverer. Another lesson, the Lord will fight for you, Moses told them, despite the huge odds against them. All those 200,000 footmen, the 50,000 soldiers, God will fight for you. It's a lesson for us. And finally, the Red Sea in front of them, Pharaoh's armies coming toward them, their situation seemed perilous. Lesson for us, end time events will seem perilous to God's elect. We must have absolute faith in God and remember the lessons of ancient Israel.